Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that my running mate, Angela Walker, and I ran on in 2020. So let me start again with Gaza. The genocide continues. This week we saw Israeli soldiers fire on desperate, hungry people seeking food from relief trucks. At least 112 Palestinians were killed and more than 750 others were injured in this barbarity. The Gaza Health Ministry estimates that, I think it's now 32,000 people have died, but that's very conservative. They, you know, only add people to that number that they can document. I want to put in the link in the chat, a link to an article that Ralph Nader put out recently, arguing that this undercount is, extreme. He estimates as many as 200,000 are dead by now. That's approaching 10% of Gaza's population. So we'll put that in the link and you can see what Ralph had to say. There have been negotiations on a ceasefire, prisoner exchange, and humanitarian aid for Gaza, but they're stalled. The U.S., Egypt, Qatar, and Hamas sent people to the latest rounds of negotiations in Cairo, but Israel did not send anybody. I guess the U.S. was their go-between. And Hamas wants Israel to commit now to a permanent ceasefire during and after three phases of hostage releases, which was on the table, but Israel refuses a permanent ceasefire. And Israel, with U.S. backing, wants to agree to only a six-week ceasefire and a first round of prisoner exchanges, and then see what happens from there. The initial six-week ceasefire would exchange 40 people that Hamas is holding, including women, elderly, sick, and five female Israeli soldiers, and the Israelis would release about 400 Palestinian prisoners. But I think we have to face the fact that Israel doesn't want to end the war. It still wants to invade Rafah. Netanyahu and his far-right coalition are afraid that the center-right coalition partners will break with the coalition and force new elections when the war ends. So they want to continue the war. The U.S. wanted an agreement by tomorrow, wanted an agreement by tomorrow, March 10th, which is the beginning of Ramadan. And it sure doesn't look like that is what's going to happen today. Instead, we can probably expect violent clashes between Muslims and Jews at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Mount Temple complex in Jerusalem. In fact, Hamas leaders are calling on Palestinians to go there, and leaders of the Jewish religious zealots are also calling on their people to go there. So clashes are quite likely that could further inflame the conflict. And we should also remember on the West Bank, under the cover of Gaza, the settlers with the backing of the U.S. or the Israeli military are stealing Palestinian land and property while all this is going on in Gaza. And the UN reported that 416 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli military on the West Bank since October 7th. The Israelis say they're fighting terrorists, but a quarter of those Palestinians killed on the West Bank by Israeli forces have been children. I mean, it's just one atrocity after another. So the far-right government of Israel is enacting ethnic cleansing and genocide right before our eyes. We have to keep up the protests. They are having an impact, at least on the posture of the U.S. and European countries. Last Sunday, Vice President Kamala Harris called for an immediate ceasefire and humanitarian aid in her speech at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the highly symbolic site of Bloody Sunday when Alabama police beat the crap out of people marching from Selma to Montgomery for voting rights in 1965. Harris's statement was the strongest statement yet for a ceasefire by anybody in the Biden administration. It does put increased pressure on the Israeli government to agree to at least a temporary ceasefire, humanitarian aid, in a prisoner exchange, but it doesn't look like it's been enough. At the same time, many European leaders who had first supported Israel's intervention in Gaza are now calling for a ceasefire. And then we saw Secretary of State Anthony Blinken meet with Benny Gantz, the center-right Israeli leader, which puts pressure on Netanyahu and his far-right coalition cabinet members. Another thing that's developed is the U.S. is providing humanitarian aid on its own, airdropping food into Gaza, but that's only a drop in the bucket. It's no substitute for the 500 or more trucks that are needed daily, which is what went into Gaza before the current war. That's just to take care of normal needs. Biden also announced in his State of the Union address that the U.S. is going to build a temporary pier for food deliveries by sea, but that's going to take somewhere between 30 and 90 days to build. And Gaza is starving now. The aid drops and the aid by sea are no substitute for Israel opening up the land crossings that they control so the aid can get into Gaza at the volume it's needed. And the U.S. has much stronger measures it could take, like halting military aid until Israel stops the slaughter in Gaza, lets the humanitarian aid in, and starts a serious process of negotiations with the Palestinians toward a political solution. Instead, while we talk about, or the U.S. talks about ceasefire, they've made over 100 military sales to Israel since October 7th. Actions speak louder than words, so we have to keep pushing. There are more demonstrations today. Chris Blankenhorn, who usually is in the background here doing the technical side of these podcasts, is at a Ceasefire Now demonstration in Springfield, Illinois today. Thanks for Jenny Lester for stepping in for him. So I hope people are taking advantage or getting involved in these demonstrations. And we also need to be calling the president and members of Congress. All you need is a short message. They just count the messages on each side of an issue more than they listen to the content. So this is something we just got to keep pushing on because we're watching genocide right before our eyes on the TV. But it's worth noting that Gaza is not the only place where civilians are dying in massive numbers from war and famine, especially in Sudan and Syria and Ukraine. In Sudan, the UN says there are 25 million people now. In Sudan, South Sudan, and Chad, because there are a lot of refugees in those latter two countries, are facing starvation as we sit here due to the civil war in Sudan. And that civil war, and it's really a war between two military factions, not between popular movements. And that civil war is fueled by military intervention. Russia, Chad, the United Arab Emirates, and their Libyan proxies in the Libyan civil war are supporting the rapid deployment forces, which is one faction of the armed forces. And on the other side, Egypt, Iran, and even Ukraine special forces are supporting the Sudanese armed forces. You know, these things make strange bedfellows. For example, Iran and Ukraine. And Ukraine is there because they want to get at the Russians who are supporting the other side in the civil war. But what we have to realize is what is sidelined in this civil war is the pro-democracy movement that forced out the longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir in 2019 and was supposed to take power in 2021 after a transition government between the civilian movement and the military. Instead, the armed forces took power in a coup in 2021. And then the Sudanese armed forces and their rapid deployment force started fighting each other for power in April last year. So the U.S. has not been engaged militarily here. It's been diplomatically supporting the transition to civilian rule, condemning the coup in 2021 and condemning the civil war. But the Sudanese pro-democracy revolutionaries say the U.S. Should have supported them instead of trying to deal with the military dictatorship. All the U.S. can do is provide humanitarian aid to Sudanese refugees in South Sudan and Chad. And what we're providing is far short of what the UN says is needed. And then in Syria, under the cover of this war in Gaza, Turkey, Syria, and Russia have increased their airstrikes against opposition-controlled areas in northern Syria. Syria and Russia are focused on Idlib in the northwest, where they back, where they fight or bomb the Turkish-backed rebels. And at the same time, Turkey's focused on Rojava in the northeast, where the Kurdish people have set up their own autonomous government. And in both places, the airstrikes are destroying civilian homes, farms, infrastructure, leaving people without heat, power, and short of food in both regions of Syria. It's just another disaster. The U.S. has 500 troops in northeastern Syria as part of its anti-ISIS mission, which it did in cooperation with the Kurds and in Iraq with the Iraqi government. But now there's a lot of talk about withdrawing those forces, leaving the Kurds to fend for themselves. And those 500 troops, I don't think they're necessary to fight the remnants of ISIS. The Kurds do that well, or to defend the Kurds from Turkey and Syria. But the U.S. should continue to provide arms to the Kurds for their self-defense. Unfortunately, the U.S. really doesn't care for the grassroots democratic, feminist, multicultural, ecological, and socialist government the Kurds have built in Rojava. It's the most progressive movement in the Middle East, and it would be a tragedy if we let it get crushed between Turkey and Syria. And then finally, in Ukraine, Russia continues its airstrikes against civilian homes and infrastructure behind the front lines as Ukraine is running out of air defense missiles. And on the front lines, Russia is throwing massive amounts of artillery, tanks, and troops against the Ukrainians defending the front lines, who have been having to ration artillery shells because of shortages. Russia continues to flatten Ukrainian towns into rubble in order to conquer them. And that is what they call liberation of the Russian speakers in the East and South. And those Russian speakers who are the victims of this bombardment are asking, you know, what are we being liberated from? Our homes, peace, and a normal life? It's a war that continues. And the blocking of U.S. aid to Ukraine by the far-right Republicans in Congress and the prospects of a Trump presidency seems to have concentrated the minds of European leaders in the last couple of weeks. They've been able to come together in the last couple of weeks to find and deliver 800,000 artillery shells to Ukraine, which desperately needs it. And now they're getting serious about planning collective defense without the U.S. if Trump comes to power, and they face far-right governments on both sides of them, Russia and America. So it looks like Ukraine will get enough economic and military aid from Europe to hold back the Russian invasion without the U.S., but that's touch and go. In all these wars, you know, the best U.S. policy, I believe, should be to offer carrots instead of sticks. U.S. military intervention just keeps the situation militarized. I'm for providing arms for self-defense to the Ukrainians and Kurds. It's the right thing to do, but not troops on the ground, because that just complicates it and makes it a geopolitical war and you know, gets the U.S. involved in a way it doesn't want to be and can't be constructive. The most constructive thing the U.S. can do is to offer humanitarian assistance and global Green New Deal development projects to all sides that can go forward when the war stops. We can't solve it. The U.S. can't solve it by itself, but it can, I think, be constructive by offering, as I've said, we should be the world's humanitarian superpower, not its military superpower. So, you know, there's a lot of war going on and a lot of tragedy, and, you know, we've got to do what we can to stop it, starting with Gaza, where we do have a lot of leverage over what the Israelis are doing between our military aid and our diplomatic cover. The other big thing this week is Supreme Court of the United States said they're going to hear Trump's immunity appeal, but they're not going to hear it until April 22nd, with a ruling likely to come in June. And what that delay is doing is increasing the likelihood that neither of the two federal indictments that Trump will come to trial before the November election. I'm talking about the attempt to steal the election around January 6th, and the classified documents case. Those two cases are Trump's looking more and more like he's going to be able to delay those until after the election. And if he gets elected, what's he going to do? He's going to tell the Justice Department to drop those charges. And, you know, think about what would happen in the fall election if these cases were on trial. It would be a media onslaught against Trump, putting him in a negative light even greater than the serial releases of parts of those 150,000 emails and documents that WikiLeaks did, and put, you know, Hillary Clinton in a negative light in the fall campaign of 2016. This would even be bigger because every day there'd be news about the trials. And this is crucial for the 2024 election because most Americans really have little idea about the charges that Trump faces. Recent polling shows that half of Americans have no or little awareness of what the allegations against Trump are. But they'll be paying more attention as the election approaches. And if Trump was on trial, they'd be seeing it every day in the headlines and the news broadcasts. But SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, may have just handed Trump the election by postponing and not dealing urgently with this bogus immunity appeal that Trump has made. He's saying because he is president, he's immune from any criminal prosecution. So if there's any good news, it's that Trump has to post cash bonds in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case and the bank fraud case. And yesterday, Trump posted a bond of $91 million in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case. And many of us were surprised he was able to do this. We know now that the bond was provided by the Federal Insurance Company, which is an arm of the insurance giant Chubb. Neither Chubb or Trump will say what the collateral is, but we know Chubb is a Swiss company that has a lot of business in Russia with major Kremlin ties where it insures much of Russia's fossil fuel infrastructure. And David K. Johnston and Seth Abramson and other reporters are calling for the court to do an inquiry into the sources of the collateral for that bond over national security concerns, given Trump's history of getting Russian financing for his businesses and the trust in Putin he has shown over the years. Trump's biggest problem will be making that $464 million cash bond by March 25th. But then again, maybe Chubb will come forward for him again. But if Trump doesn't have the money, he's going to have to file for personal bankruptcy, which would be, you know, personally humiliating for Trump, whose brand is that he's a brilliant businessman and multi-billionaire. And it will show that the brand was also a big lie and a con. Trump may still have another trick up his sleeve in terms of getting his money. His Truth Social, which is his answer to Twitter or X, just got SEC approval to do a IPO, an initial public offering of stock through a shell company called Digital World Acquisition Corp. And this is a highly speculative and volatile stock, but it could give Trump a windfall of up to $4 billion if the stock sells at the higher values it's had over the last month. But as a major stockholder, Trump would have to wait 6 months before cashing in his stocks. So they won't make good collateral for cash bonds for the courts. So, and the other complication is that Trump's former executives at Truth Social, who came to him with the idea for doing this Twitter-like platform, are suing him to stop the IPO. So, you know, that's one of the advantages we have dealing with the capitalists. They're out for themselves, not for each other. They enjoy cannibalizing each other as much as they do exploiting the rest of us. In popular classes, we can take advantage of those divisions if we're united. So the lawsuits by Truth Social's former executives are being expedited, but Trump is running out of time before he may have to file for personal bankruptcy. But all I can say in summation of all this is that it's amazing that this Trump guy, who is a crook, congenital liar, tried to steal the last presidential election, is going to be one of the two major party candidates this year. And frankly, it's just as amazing that the Democrats are not putting up a candidate who could easily landslide this criminal, ignorant, wannabe dictator that the Republicans are running. You know, that tells us there's a political vacuum for a party that expresses the progressive views of the majority of Americans on questions like climate and economic inequality and health care for all. And for that matter, a party that just is competent and has common sense and the broad public interest in mind instead of the special private interests of the corporate rich who buy these politicians' elections. In other words, the objective conditions are there for a Green Party to grow and fill this vacuum, and that's up to us. So let me say a few words about the State of the Union. I think, and most people agree, Biden did well from a performative point of view. He was vigorous, forceful, and nimble in parrying the heckling from Republicans. But the content is another story from our point of view. Take immigration. Biden baited the Republicans with their own mean-spirited language for not adopting the reactionary border patrol or border control bill that was basically their policies. And in doing so, he used the term illegal to describe an immigrant instead of undocumented who was alleged to have murdered a woman in Atlanta. In other words, you know, he has the same mentality in terms of policy and even the language he uses as the Republicans on the immigration issue. And as I've been saying, you know, Biden could, he won't, but the Democrats could and they won't, but we can ridicule the Republicans for turning the immigration of oppressed and poor people into a national security threat when they won't even pass military aid to Ukraine for its self-defense. It's not about national security. It's not about the immigrants. It's about using these issues, using immigrants as scapegoats to advance their own political agendas. And Biden's trade and immigration policies are basically Trump scapegoating First America First policies without the racist rhetoric when you look at the substance. So then let's look at climate. I mean, he hardly said any words about that. He only got to it in the second half of his speech. And he made big claims and offered no initiatives to back them up. He said, quote, "I'm taking the most significant action on climate ever in the history of the world. I'm cutting our carbon emissions by half in 2030. I mean, here he sounds just like Trump. Big bombastic claims, no substance. He's not going to cut emissions by half in 2030. What we got is Joe Manchin's pro-fossil fuel Inflation Reduction Act, which is what I've been calling the Build Back Badly bill. And the Democrats are basically have the attitude, we did climate already. We passed that bill. And of course, the Republican refrain is drill, baby, drill. So we're in big trouble on climate. And, you know, that State of the Union, you know, gave us no reassurance that people are even thinking about this in the Biden administration. And then I think what Biden did, which was politically good, was sprinkle in a lot of progressive tax reforms, but they're not very progressive when you actually look at them in terms of US history, the deficit problem, and growing economic inequality. He said he has a plan to reduce the deficit by $3 trillion over 10 years. In other words, austerity when we need a massive investment in decarbonizing the economy, which is going to take deficit spending. I mean, we can't just tax and pay as we go. We got to borrow that money and get those investments made if we're going to get the carbon out of the economy in the time frame we need. And then he said he was going to increase the top corporate income tax rate to 20%, 28%, partially reversing the tax cuts that occurred with the Trump tax cuts in 2017. And at that time, the top tax rate was dropped from 35% to 21%. And since then, it went lower with the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, their climate bill. But why not completely repeal the Trump cuts? I mean, we're meeting the Republicans, or the Democrats are meeting the Republicans halfway again. And then he said he'd raise the minimum corporate income tax rate to 21% for major corporations, up from the current level of 15%, which was in the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. But that's just back to the Trump rate of 2017. Why not a corporate tax rate of around 50%, which is what it was around from the 1940s until the 1980s? And the economy boomed in that period. Well, 70s weren't so good, but the late 40s, 50s, and 60s were you know, the golden age of American capitalism. We grew and employed more people than we ever had. And then he said he'd institute a minimum income tax of 25% for the wealthiest 1/100th of 1%. What's that, 1 in 10,000? Which are those who make more than $100 million a year. It's a very small group of people. But why not a more progressive graduated income and wealth taxes to generate more revenues to meet the people's needs, deal with this Green New Deal, and reduce the obscene level of economic inequality? You know, so what we're getting are half measures. He said he would make permanent the enhanced subsidies for health insurance persons purchased on the exchanges of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, which are scheduled to expire after 2025. In other words, he wants to make permanent public subsidies for private insurance instead of enacting a public health care system for all. He said he would renew the 2017 tax cuts. This is the Trump tax cuts for those earning less than $400,000, which most of the tax cuts for those above. But in other words, he's talking about keeping the Trump tax cuts for the upper middle class making between $100,000 and $400,000. And that tells you who the Democrats' real base is. It's the professional managerial class, not the working class. And I got more in my notes, but you get the point. Overall, the policy content is centrist. It's not the kind of radical solutions we need to address climate inequality and war. And that's why we need the Green Party. I will give him credit for saying we need to bring back the child tax credit we had during the pandemic. That was the most effective anti-child poverty policy in U.S. history. That's a good point. So we'll give him credit for that. But I'm going to stop here. I could talk no more about the State of the Union address. But before I open it up, I want to announce that next week we'll have a guest. He is Nadal Batari. He's a Palestinian refugee who was raised in Syria's Yarmouk refugee camp. And he's a veteran of both the Syrian and Palestinian liberation struggles. His family was prominent politically in the Yarmouk refugee camp, so much so that hours before seizing power in 1970, Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, and his circle met at his grandfather's house. And just to show you what happened, I mean, the Assads didn't care about the Palestinians and, in fact, flattened Yarmouk refugee camp during the revolution in the early 2010s. And today, his grandfather's house is rubble, the victim of Hafez's son, Bashar al-Assad, which was a war on all opposition in Syria, including the Palestinian refugees. So Nadal has a lot of experience and stories to tell, and you know, also talk about the liberation struggles in both Palestine and Syria. And we'll put a chat article, a link to an article in the chat where Nadal describes growing up in these movements. So I'll stop there, and let's take your questions and comments. Chris Blankenhorn, comments on Sweden joining NATO. Well, it was a matter of time. And, you know, Putin says NATO forced him into invading Ukraine. And what has he got? Finland and Sweden immediately saying, we need to get into NATO because we're afraid of Russia's imperialism. I don't want to see NATO be the central military alliance for Europe. I think what we need is to go back to what Gorbachev called for when Germany was unified and said we need a security architecture that includes Russia and the rest of Europe and America He called it our common European home. That's what we should be for, you know, fighting for diplomatically. We actually did take Putin up on some of his demands right before the war started in December 2021. He demanded that NATO withdraw to its 1991 footprint when Germany reunified, or else was the 200,000 troops he'd amassed on Ukraine's border. That was just not a serious demand. I mean, to get the, at that time, 30 countries in NATO to agree to, you know, withdraw like that was just not in the cards. But the U.S. did tell, you know, Putin, well, let's talk about security architecture. And Putin was not responsive and then invaded. So what we really need is a U.S. diplomatic approach that is, you know, putting Russia on the spot, not just on terms of, you know, a common security architecture that satisfies everybody, but also these arms control treaties. You know, the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty under George W. Bush. We pulled out of the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty under Trump, and also the open skies treaty. Russia pulled out of the conventional armed forces treaty for Europe. And now they're refusing to negotiate. Russia's refusing to negotiate with the U.S. on renewing the New START treaty, which is the big strategic nuclear arms control agreement. So we're in a crisis there. And, you know, what I think is we need a diplomatic surge with, as you know, I campaigned on in 2020, we need nuclear disarmament initiatives. Like, we don't need land-based nuclear missiles. They're just a target. They destabilize. We don't even need the strategic bombers. We can provide a deterrent with the submarine launched ballistic missiles. We can reduce them to a minimum credible deterrent. And with those nuclear disarmament initiatives, go to Russia, go to China, go to all the nuclear powers and say, let's get rid of these weapons. We're ready to do that now. And let's all get into the treaty for the, what is it? The treaty on, I want to say the abolition, but it's the treaty. I forget the name of it exactly, but it's a treaty that's now been approved by over 50 countries and over 100 are looking at it, that would basically abolish nuclear weapons and would create a process for mutual disarmament. And I'll remember the name of that treaty. It's not Treaty for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, but I just can't remember the exact words. But anyway, we need nuclear disarmament initiatives. Instead of, you know, making NATO the central, the center of our security, because if we're in confrontation with Russia, instead of trying to meet mutual security arrangements, you know, there's the danger of war. The other thing, as I've mentioned in the opening, you know, Sweden, Finland are among those countries in Europe now saying we got to get our act together because the U.S., if Trump gets elected, are not going to have our backs. In fact, they may be opposed to us. You know, Trump told he didn't care what Putin did. He can do anything the hell he wants to Europe. So, you know, that like concentrated their minds. So, you know, from Sweden's point of view, they need NATO, but we need to go beyond NATO. And that's where I think the diplomacy should be, you know, much more front and center. Andrew Hager, comments or thoughts on what John Stewart said about the major conflict between Israel and Palestine? I don't know what he said. I guess there have been news stories about it. I haven't paid attention. I know he got back to his daily show, but I just don't know what he said. So I can't comment. Chris Blankenhorn, response to Representative Santos saying he'll run for Congress again after being expelled. He's raising money for his legal defense, just like Trump is. That's what that's about. Nobody in Long Island's going to elect that guy. Nobody there trusts him anymore. He's just a joke. So he's just raising money he hopes for his legal defense, but I'm not sure how many people are willing to give him money at this point. Andrew Hager, comments or thoughts on Nikki Haley dropping out of the race? It was not surprising. You know, she tried to provide an alternative to Trump. It wasn't very attractive to me. I mean, she's very conservative and, you know, not that different from Trump on many policies. So she's out, but Trump's still in. You know, I think what we got to focus on is, you know, building an alternative to both the Democrats and Republicans. Right now, you know, they're just not dealing with the problems that we face. And we got serious problems between the climate, growing inequality, the new nuclear arms race, and so forth. Andrew Hager, some questions regarding Biden's contribution to the Scranton, New York City track reconstruction, if I hadn't asked you before. I'm not sure about the details of that railroad, but I will say that Amtrak Joe has been a disappointment in terms of his own promises running for office in 2020 about how he was going to, you know, rebuild passenger rail. We should be expanding freight rail, getting a lot of the over-the-road trucking onto rails, which is much more energy efficient and resource efficient. And, you know, what we should have, and, you know, I was actually, Jill Stein asked me for some comments or suggested talking points for how to respond to this latest track, you know, derailment where there were toxic chemicals spilled in Pennsylvania. And I said, you know, there've been so many of these derailments, it's time to nationalize the railroads and bring them under democratic community and worker control and have them operate at cost for the public interest rather than at cost plus profits for private shareholders who have, you know, they have underinvested in infrastructure to keep the railroad safe and staffing of the lines. I mean, all these big railroads have far fewer staff than they used to have, which has contributed to some of these accidents. So what we really need is a national rail system that deals with freight rails and passenger rails, including high-speed rail between cities and commuter rail within cities. You know, that's, I think, a big part of what a Green New Deal would provide. And as part of the overall planning, you would integrate the new transportation, particularly within cities, with new public housing that is powered by green energy and helps build walkable communities instead of these sprawling car-dependent communities. There's so much we could do with that. And so Amtrak Joe has been a big disappointment. I can't speak specifically to the Scranton, New York City track reconstruction. But if there's a little bit of that happening, I guess it's good because most of the infrastructure, transportation infrastructure money that's being spent out of the Inflation Reduction Act is on roads. And there was an article this week saying, forget the statistic exactly, but by 2040, we'll be, I forget what it was, but emitting a massive amount of carbon on these roads they're building. So, you know, we need to rebuild the rails and reduce the roads. Andrew Hager, speaking of fossil fuels, Howie, would you mind refreshing my memory of your opinion on converting various vehicles to run on more renewable ones like biodiesel and the like? I think we want electric vehicles powered by clean renewable generated by wind and solar. Biodiesel, I don't see a use for that. I could see a use for, biogas where it's already being produced, like at landfills and water treatment plants. And it's better to capture that methane and burn it to generate electricity than to let that methane escape into the atmosphere. If you burn it for electricity, you'll get carbon dioxide. You'll get some noxious chemicals like sulfur oxides and nitrogen oxides, but on a small scale. I see that as a niche kind of biofuel where you already have the methane. Other than that, we can do it all with electric vehicles. There are problems there. You've got to find the mineral resources, the what do they call them, the rare earth minerals, and you got to extract them and then recycle them in a way that's environmentally friendly. There's a lot of work to do there, but there's enough of those rare earth minerals, and we may have to pay a little bit more for them, but they should be extracted in a way that's safe for the miners. And once we got them in the economy, we should be recycling them, not dumping them into some landfill. Emil Sachs, HH, just saw a news item that a relative of Mitch McConnell died when their Tesla's doors would not open in an accident. Thoughts on Tesla, and will someone finally move in to rein in Musk? Well, I wouldn't trust self-driving cars, certainly at this point, because there are just too many cases where they've gone wrong. I don't know about this particular case where the doors would not open in an accident. That can sometimes happen with a conventional car, so I don't know the details of that. But Musk is a problem. He's one of the three richest men in the world. Maybe he's the richest man at the moment. And he's throwing his, billionaire wealth around, between, X, formerly Twitter, Tesla, the space stuff. And he's a right-wing nut. He's a conspiracy nut. I mean, this guy, for somebody who's so smart when it comes to technical problems, he's got no social empathy or understanding when he talks about public policy. And unfortunately, he's got a lot of money to get his ideas around. And being a rich guy, some people admire him for that and listen to every word he says as if it's worth listening to. So I think one thing to rein in Musk is progressive wealth tax. And over time, it should, reduce wealth to still very rich, maybe a few billion, but it would not the hundreds of billions that he has. And that's one way to get greater equality in the society and take away the wealth that has such political influence as well as economic influence. And then we need to look at socializing some of the things that Musk is doing, whether it's car manufacturing, space. Space should be a public venture, not private enterprise. And it should be international, not, nationalist in its, approach. And then the auto industry, if they were, what's happening now is they are delaying transition to electric vehicles and extending the time that we're going to have internal combustion engines burning fossil fuels. And, we should set the standards, and if they can't meet them, take them over. We should have kept ownership of a couple of them when they were bailed out in 2008. And I used to work with a group, they're still around, called Auto Workers. Auto Workers Caravan. And they took a caravan from the Detroit area down to Washington, D.C. To push for legislation that would force the auto companies to, as they were recovered with public money, start building, mass transportation and electric vehicles and wind generators and solar panels, the renewable transition that we need, instead of going back to, building gas guzzlers. If they won't do that based on public policy and regulation, then we should just take them over and make it happen under, public ownership and control. And that includes Tesla. Vicky Corden, Viktor Orban came to Mar-a-Lago. He is an autocrat. Any thoughts? Yeah. One article I read is you know, Viktor Orban has hollowed out Hungarian democracy, you know, undermined the independent judiciary, free elections, you know, he can rig the elections. And some people say he was there to tutor Trump on how to do it if he gets elected. You know, Viktor Orban is a problem. He's a total opportunist. Originally, after the Soviet Union broke up, he was kind of a social democrat on the left of Hungarian politics, but seems to have figured out that he could take the executive and basically make himself, you know, the dictator, the guy that runs, the autocrat that runs everything. So, you know, birds, what's the phrase? Birds of a feather flock together. Not surprising that Trump and Orban are chit-chatting in Mar-a-Lago. B.D. Dimmitt, the NATO fans' rhetoric over Russia having borders with NATO members, if it successfully claims all of Ukraine, there are at least three of those NATO memberships that are blatant violations of the non-treaty agreement regarding NATO expansion. So I think what you're talking about is people in the George H.W. Bush administration told Gorbachev, and it was James Baker, I think Secretary of State at the time, told Gorbachev, you know, or a Russian official, we're not going to move NATO 1 inch eastward. And, you know, the Russians took that as, you know, a solemn commitment, even though there was nothing written down, there was no treaty. And over the years, Clinton really led the expansion with, what's her name? She recently died on the tip of my tongue. She was Secretary of State. She said the U.S. is the indispensable nation. Madeleine Albright, you know, really pushing for it, along with people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was not formally in the Clinton administration, but was very influential. And that was a, you know, a terrible thing to do. So the last NATO expansion to Russia's borders was in 2004. And it's more than three countries. It's all three Baltic states. It's Poland. It's Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria. And that's if you count Ukraine as part of Russia, which Russia wants to do and Ukraine doesn't. They say, you know, we're Ukrainians. We have our own country. So, you know, the irony for Russia is after they invaded, the length of the borders Russia directly has with NATO more than doubled because Finland joined. And that's the biggest border Russia now has with NATO. So, but like I said, we need to be exploring ways to get beyond NATO and, you know, challenging Putin and the Russian leadership to negotiate over those things. I mean, right now they think they're on a roll. They're going to roll over to Ukraine, given that the U.S. has stopped providing military aid. I think Europe stepped into the gap. Ukraine will be able to hold the line pretty well this year, but it's a difficult situation. But Putin, I mean, he says he wants to negotiate. And then when he mentions the terms, it's, you know, we'll negotiate the complete capitulation of Ukraine, which the Ukrainians are never going to accept. So it's a bad situation. But I don't think it's about NATO because, you know, why didn't Russia respond to Finland joining NATO militarily? They didn't. And Ukraine, actually, you know, they haven't even got a membership action plan from NATO. You know, NATO's telling them, particularly Germany and the U.S., that you can't join until the war's over. And then we'll talk about it. And this has been going on since 2008 when George W. Bush first proposed it. And here we are, what, 16 years later? And Ukraine hasn't, you know, moved an inch toward NATO membership. They do have some integration militarily in terms of systems and, you know, operation, but, you know, that's because they're trying to defend themselves from Russia's invasion. So I think the NATO thing is not what really motivated Putin. It's his, you know, Russian world ideology and Russian great chauvinist or great Russian chauvinism and imperialism. You know, he wants to rebuild the Russian Empire. Nada Barca, have you heard of Helen Energy, BTS? They have an exotic approach to plasma fusion that seems scalable and avoids a lot of the security and health issues of fission. I think they're on a third generation working prototype that hope to be able to power 20,000 homes with one generator. Well, I have been hearing about fusion my whole life, and nothing commercial is even, you know, from what I read, is within decades. The only fusion plant we need is already there. It's the sun. And it generates solar radiation, which we can capture for electricity. That solar radiation creates the winds by, you know, warming, you know, parts of the planet. And then the, you know, the air moves between warm and cool areas. So we have the fusion plant we need. It's the sun, and we can capture that energy with solar and wind. Violated Content Boutique. Howard, you think we'll be living in dome cities in 5 to 10 years? No, I mean, that's just too expensive. It's too big a construction site. No, I think what we'll be doing, hopefully, is cleaning the air with renewable energy. You know, domed, you know, homes or, you know, apartment buildings, maybe for the rich, but I don't think that's in the cards. False music. Howie, have you read Ernest Kallenbach's Ecotopia? How do you think that is the kind of America? And do you think that is the kind of America we should be aiming for? Besides the part where we fight each other with spears. yeah, I read that when it first came out. When was that? The 70s? And, you know, I thought there's a lot of there's a lot that's attractive in the vision. I thought the biggest flaw was that it, you know, they thought, you know, I guess California and Oregon, whatever Ecotopia boundaries were, could kind of separate and set up an alternative that was not interacting with the rest of the evil world. I thought that was not realistic. But in terms of, you know, everyday life in Ecotopia, I thought there was a lot to it. Although it's been so long since I read it, I just don't recall many of the details. Like, I don't remember the part about spears, but now you're kind of bringing it back. So it's jiggling a memory. So what, are we waiting for a question? Oh, I see an easy one. Chabela Morena, how do we defeat capitalism? If there was an easy answer to that, it would have happened by now. But I would say what we need is a mass movement and a, you know, an eco-socialist party that's a mass party. And they have to complement each other, because if we start electing Greens, eco-socialists to elected office, we aren't, you know, a lot of the power is not up for election in a capitalist society. It's the capitalist class owning the means of production, and they can resist changes that the government wants to do, the reforms it wants to make, by going on a capital strike and wrecking the economy, blaming the reformers. So we got to have a movement that, you know, says we have to go beyond, you know, regulating, but, you know, taking over. And then, you know, there will be forces, or there'll be a counter-revolution if we get to that stage. Look at Allende's Chile. There the slogan was, "We must make haste slowly." They were trying to not anger the far right too much while pleasing the popular movements that wanted to move faster. And in the end, the right, you know, staged a coup and killed Allende, and 20,000 of, you know, the people in the movement, and imprisoned a lot more. So that's where we have to have a movement that's willing to take direct action to back up the reforms the government wants to do, which means things like factory seizures and massive nonviolent resistance, engaging with troops that might be called upon to put down the revolution and winning them over. That happens in almost every revolution. So in a nutshell, you know, that's what it will take. I don't think we can reform capitalism away reform by reform. At some point, the people in power in the capitalist system will say enough is enough, and they'll dispense with democratic means and try to suppress us violently. And we have to have an answer to that, which should be massive, mostly nonviolent action, basically to seize the power that's in the economy and the means of production, which now, you know, the capitalists own. So, you know, electoral politics is part of it, but we also have to have a movement, and there has to be a consciousness among masses of people that this is what we need to do. So, you know, that's a process. We need a party that is well organized and has a good educational program that is getting that perspective out in the population. And unfortunately, we're a long way from that. So the left had mass parties in the early part of the 20th century. And since the new left, which had good criticisms of the old left, particularly the communist left, which was, you know, apologizing for autocracy and places like Russia, and the social democratic left, which had basically made its peace with capitalism and kind of wanted a social welfare state next to a capitalist economy. And that's not stable either. So, you know, we need to revive parties. I mean, right now, and this is not just in the United States, it's in Europe too, people's participation in political parties is way down, as it is with lots of civic organizations. And, you know, if we're going to have collective action, we got to have organization. So that's a big challenge. And Violet at Content Boutique, how we have green memberships picked up this election cycle? Well, as you know, we don't have a national membership. You know, you can't join the National Green Party as an individual member. You join state parties, which it varies from state to state. Some states do have dues-paying memberships. Other states recognize you as a member if you register in that party with the Board of Election. Other states don't have that registration process, so you have to register with the party itself to be recognized. And, you know, we could do a lot better in all three of those ways of getting our rank and file members involved, particularly in building locals where people can participate on a regular basis and not be detached individuals who are just reading about this online. So I have no idea if we've picked up memberships in this election cycle. I hope we have, and I hope that's leading the grassroots organization. But we really don't have a measure for that. The National Party certainly doesn't do it. You have to go sort of state by state. So I certainly encourage people, and particularly, as I've said here many times, we got to build strong locals that people can participate in, which, you know, improves the effectiveness of all of us, because, you know, we learn, particularly in the give and take of discussion about, you know, our policies and actions at the local level. I guess it's time to wrap up. As I mentioned before, and maybe we can put this in the chat again, next week it'll be Nidal Batari, who's a Syrian, a Palestinian who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in Syria and has been involved in liberation struggles in both countries, who has a unique history and intimate relationship to both struggles. So we're going to talk about Palestine and Syria next week. And I hope you can be there. And until then, have a good week and keep you know, demanding a ceasefire, hostage exchange, or prisoner exchange, and humanitarian aid into Gaza. That's I think, the top of the agenda for us right now. So have a good week, everybody.